Omaha Public Radio presents a special program on Noon Forum. We'll hear the 14th Annual Governor's Lecture in the Humanities, presented by the Nebraska Humanities Council, the University of Nebraska, and Valmont Industries. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Wednesday evening, November 4th, 2009, for broadcast at this time. Today's guest speaker will be Matt Miller, author of The Tyranny of Dead Ideas, Letting Go of the Old Ways of Thinking to Unleash a New Prosperity. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the Nebraska Humanities Council, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Nebraska Governor Dave Heineman.
I'm very pleased to have the opportunity tonight to introduce the speaker for the 14th Annual Governor's Lecture in the Humanities. This lecture series has brought together a group of distinguished historians, authors, and journalists to Nebraska to discuss issues ranging from U.S. politics to foreign policy, as well as the social and historical issues that impact our citizens and others around the world. We are pleased to continue the tradition of a spirited dialogue with this year's presenter, Matt Miller. Mr. Miller is the author of several books, including The 2% Solution, and most recently, The Tyranny of Dead Ideas. He is a columnist, radio host, and consultant working with corporations, foundations, and government organizations on strategy and policy. He is a frequent contributor to the Financial Times, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, and the New York Times. His policy experience includes serving from 1993 to 1995 as a senior advisor to the director of the White House Office of Management and Budget in the Clinton administration, and his public policy work today includes serving as a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming our distinguished guest, Mr. Matt Miller.
Thank you. Thanks very much, Governor. And I know how busy you are with Nebraska being in special session, literally as we speak, and facing a budget crunch like so many states. But as I've looked at it in the last few days, it's clear that Nebraska, even though it's got challenging times, is facing a better situation than a lot of states. And I think that's a credit to the culture of Nebraska, to the fiscal conservatism of the state, and so an tribute, I'm sure, to your own leadership. So I appreciate your taking time out of what I know is a busy schedule. And I'm probably scooping what would have been a press release that the governor wanted to issue tomorrow, but it was interesting. Over cocktails, we negotiated an arrangement whereby everybody here tonight and every organization you're affiliated with is totally exempt from any cuts in the coming session that will be done. I'm sure I'm scooping an announcement he wants to make tomorrow, but in all seriousness, I appreciate his taking the time. Now, I'm from California, which is the capital of public sector dysfunction, if you've been following the news at all these days, but I have been assured that this is not a communicable disease. So you cannot be infected with whatever is ailing California tonight by any proximity to me. You can't catch it like swine flu or other stuff. It's also a pleasure to be in Omaha. I have not been to Omaha in 20 years when I was obviously a much younger man, and the city looks great to me. There is so much going on. Venues like this that when I was a younger man did not know existed are fabulous. There's building going on. There's a planned development nearby that I saw being worked on downtown, and though I know it's an economic time of strain for the whole country, it seems, at least as I've been able to pick up in conversation with Nebraskans just today, that you've escaped some of the worst of it and, in fact, are showing real progress in a number of areas. So I think it's a treat. I also have to say that as I was going to a couple of events today, I had a chance to speak over with the students at the university who were terrific. On the way, I saw these lovely bedroom communities with lots of very nice homes, and when I asked what the prices were of these houses, remember, I'm from Los Angeles, I've begun to start to think and email my wife that if we sold our place in L.A. and came here, I could probably retire much sooner than I had planned. So whether it's a good thing or not, you may be seeing a lot more of me very soon. I also want to thank whoever designed the wonderful centerpieces and arrangements at the table tonight. As you can imagine, I've given a few talks on the tyranny of dead ideas, but I have never seen light bulbs in the centerpieces and the painted light bulbs in the display. My daughter, who's 12, who was the one who actually had the first idea to use a broken light bulb on the cover of the book, which the publisher thought was a good idea, will be thrilled to hear about this. And so just on a personal level, I appreciate that greatly. And I also want to thank so many of the hosts and folks who helped make this day possible and so smooth, including Chuck and Jane and Jeanette and Kim and Diney and Melissa and others. I appreciate your help and hospitality and graciousness. Now, I have to say also that it's a privilege to be at an event that is under the aegis of the Nebraska Council on the Humanities and the Foundation for the Humanities. My own view, having a chance to travel around the country and speak in various forums, is that these kind of high-quality civic venues are a kind of shrinking presence in American life in too many cities. And the idea that there's something as vibrant as what this organization and these organizations can do for a community like Omaha and for Nebraska, I think is vital in our public life and in an age of sound bites and kind of shrinking warped discourse, and we'll talk about that more this evening, is something that's increasingly important. And obviously, you know, the humanities are vital in any time, but especially at a time of economic stress, the ability for governments and for private donors to dig deep to try and keep and sustain the role of organizations like this and the vital activities and sense of community that they provide for all of us, I think is incredibly important. So I applaud you and I applaud the work that you do. We obviously meet at an auspicious moment. The election yesterday, for those of you who are following these things, has already, in my view at least, been in the process within 24 hours of being so overanalyzed and the implications of it so overhyped from here to kingdom come in ways that I think people tend to dramatically overinterpret the results of these things, I think. But one thing I would say it was unmistakably clear from the elections yesterday, and that is Americans are anxious about their economic future and about the economy, and they're impatient for change and for solutions, and they're frustrated with leaders in all sectors who they aren't sure are up to the task of providing them. Now, we're obviously in the midst of what has been one of the most serious economic downturns in decades, and we're past the worst, I believe, and thank goodness, and hopefully on a path to move forward. But I think Americans are right to be having this anxiety about their economic future, and I think that they're right to question whether their leaders are thinking properly about the challenges we face. My own view, and what's going to be our theme tonight, is that our leaders and all of us are stuck in a lot of old ways of thinking, things that are holding us back from coping with the really the revolution that's going on in the economy and the global economy around us. And so we are trapped in what I call dead ideas. Now, it seems to me that a state with a unicameral legislature is a place that may be open to different ways of thinking about how we ought to do things, because that's a kind of interesting and relatively unique, as you know, set of arrangements. So I take that as a sign that Nebraskans are, not just the tradition, obviously, of populism and progressive thought, but a sign of a willingness to think outside the box a little bit in ways I hope I'll challenge tonight. Although I heard different opinions on unicameral legislature as I made my way through various venues today. Some people said that's a dead idea. Maybe we can talk about that in the Q&A, but it's certainly interesting. I also, I'm ignorant of the way states with unicameral legislatures actually operated, I took a minute and looked it up on Wikipedia, which, as you know, is the one-stop shop these days for getting smart on something quickly, if you can believe what it says. And one of the things it talked about was that unicameral legislatures are considered common in socialist countries like China and Cuba, where, interestingly, there was a tradition where the whole view of the upper house, of a Senate, the whole notion of an upper house was considered oligarchical and elitist and very bourgeois. So I don't think anyone would accuse current Nebraskan politics of tilting toward communism, but there is an interesting, observation, I think, at least, that can be drawn from that. I also think that a state that can give the nation my friend Bob Kerry as a senator, and I'm a big fan of Bob Kerry's. I understand he'll be in town tomorrow giving a talk at a related humanities conference that's going on, has to be at least tolerant of some eclectic thinking, which Bob, a knowing laugh from the audience is what comes, right? So I hope that means I may face a friendly reception with some of the thoughts and provocations I want to share with you tonight. What I want to talk about tonight is what I call dead ideas, which in my mind is an eternal universal phenomena that plagues us. It's the result of an essential vulnerability in human nature and human psychology having to do with our slowness in updating the way we think about the world, even when the world itself radically changes. So we'll talk tonight about the trouble we get into when we cling to the things we think we know. Now, in my view, it was a failure to explode a dead idea that got us into the economic ditch we're in now. The idea that financial markets can regulate themselves. Remember that idea, which was quite current. And yet there were people raising the alarm about that as early as 5 or 6 years ago. If we had unearthed and reformed and moved past that dead idea, not through some kind of massive government intervention or anything approaching socialism, which critics would sometimes allege would be the case, but through really common sense rules and a few common sense requirements, like adequate capital standards for banks, like a requirement perhaps that that those who were in the business of syndicating mortgages, these kind of no down payment, no income, no proof of income loans, had to keep some skin in the game before they passed those packages of mortgages through the system. Even rules on executive pay, perhaps, that would have required that instead of being able to get full bonuses peddling mortgage securities that were fated to implode. And so we've got lots of folks from Wall Street who ended up retired at the country club with $30 or $50 or $100 million, while the actual securities that they peddled imploded in ways that taxpayers are now clearing up to the tune of literally trillions of dollars. A few modest changes might have helped us avoid a lot of the pain and suffering and the shock that the economy has gone through in the last 18 months. With a lot of suffering, obviously, for millions of American families and a huge chunk of our businesses. Now, I think that likewise, just as the failure to explode a dead idea got us into this ditch, unless we unearth and take into the light and dust the dirt off and move beyond a series of dead ideas I'm going to talk about in everything from healthcare, taxes, schools, trade, and more, we will not find our way back to a robust prosperity, which ought to be the goal that all of us share. But I would suggest to you that this concept of dead ideas also applies to your personal life and to the organizations you work in. Obviously, we all know, we're all familiar with either in business or in nonprofits we may be associated with, how organizations get calcified in old ways of doing things. At a personal level, of course, this happens as well. We know that in our relationships. Anyone who's been married for any length of time knows that old ideas can fester in ways that can become corrosive if they're not reexamined. So I think at every level, we're prey to what I'm calling these dead ideas. And I want to persuade you that, especially in our public life, we're in the grip of some big ones, that they're holding us back, but that you can overcome them individually, that together we can overcome them as a nation. And when we do, your life will be better, your country will be better, plus you'll probably lose weight and look better than you have in years. I cannot overstate the power of overcoming dead ideas. Your friends will admire you, strangers will notice, you'll exude a certain vitality and charm. So I want you to think of The Tyranny of Dead Ideas as a self-help book disguised as a book that's out to change the way you think about politics and economics. Because I believe, in all seriousness, that the battle to save the economy and rebuild our future really does start inside our heads. So, what are dead ideas? Which ones are tyrannizing us? And how do we break free? Dead ideas is the phrase I use to describe old ways of thinking that we cling to, even though circumstances radically change. conventional wisdoms that retain their power long after it makes sense to hold on to them, or beliefs that, while comforting, are so at odds with reality that they amount to delusions that hold us back and, in some cases, even doom us to fail. The story I tell about dead ideas starts with some grim realities because the situation we're in now is serious. But it ends with enormous hope. So long as each of us commits to moving past old ways of thinking that no longer make sense, and as importantly, to making the world safe for our leaders to do the same, because that's the way democracy works. Unless enough of us as constituents form an audience in a group that makes politicians feel safe stepping out of some of the traditional rhetoric and ways of thinking, they will think it's too risky to do this. And so the onus is on us as citizens to make this possible. Now, not everyone shares my passion for exploding these dead ideas, I have to confess. Stephen Colbert, if you know him, is actually one of them. I had the chance when the book first came out to do the Colbert Report, which if you need a good laugh, just go to my website and you can watch 4 minutes of him dicing me up so hysterically. It's a perfect coffee break item if you need a break at work. But one of the fun things about doing that show is before you go on, someone from his staff comes up and says, listen, there's a writing staff that works for Colbert, and the writers have prepared some questions for Stephen to use. He may not use them, but we don't want you to be sitting across from him the first time you hear these, so we just wanted to give you a sense of what he might ask, just so you'll have 3 minutes, you know, before you go on, to think about that. So the first question is, this is obviously having fun with a book called The Tyranny of Dead Ideas, was, why should we get rid of the old ideas if the new ideas suck? The next question was, even if the old ideas don't work anymore, shouldn't we still practice them out of a sense of tradition? Now, my answer to that is obviously no, and I'd like to persuade you to share that point of view tonight. The way I frame this is, I think we're in a moment that's like 1928. If you had asked average Americans in 1928, should the federal government play a role in providing some kind of security for senior citizens in their old age? Should the federal government do something to tide people and families over when someone's lost a job before they get traction in new employment? Should the federal government intervene at all to try and mitigate the effects of an economic downturn? In 1928, the answer held by most Americans would have been no. These were matters for the local community or private charity, but not matters for the federal government. By 1940, those propositions were considered common sense. The climate of opinion had been transformed by events. Now, we're obviously, I think, past the worst and we'll see nothing like a repeat of the Great Depression. Thank goodness. We had policymakers who, even if they were behind the curve in some ways, have been throwing trillions of dollars up against the wall in what I think of as spaghetti economics. Trillions of dollars against the wall. Enough of that will stick and has stuck, even if imperfectly, to avoid the worst. And I think we're seeing the evidence of that already in the latest figures on economic growth that came out the other day. It's another question how we're going to begin to pull this stuff back and get out of the mess of these debt and deficits once we're past the worst, but we won't have a repeat of what happened in the 1930s, thank goodness. But I do think, all the same, we're in a similar way at the leading edge of a revolution in ideas about the way we think about the role of government, the role of corporations, and the role of individuals in assuring the kind of opportunity and security we expect and want in a wealthy nation like the United States. And I think that we're in some ways, a perilous moment where there are two roads we can go down. There's a road that we go down where the competition now provided by rising powers like India and China and the threat that poses to many of our own workers and their standard of living, something new in American economic history, breeds so much insecurity and anxiety among average Americans that it leads to a protectionist backlash, which in my view would be terrible for us, terrible for the world, would stop the power of capitalism and markets from elevating so many people out of poverty around the globe, which they need access to the advanced country markets to be able to do, and we'd end up in a very destructive, vicious downward cycle. But I think it's also clear that there are ways to avoid these dark scenarios and flourish. That's the good news. The bad news is we are not doing what we need to do because of what I'm calling the tyranny of dead ideas. So in the book, I lay out a handy three-step process for identifying and getting past these dead ideas. It's perfectly safe to try this at home, but I'm going to give you a preview of this tonight if you haven't had a chance to look at the book, so you'll understand the basic argument, and then we can have a good dialogue at the end. But please know, even in the Cliff Notes version that I'll give you tonight, this doesn't exempt you from actually reading the book. You won't want to miss the soaring prose, the fascinating historical narrative, the accessible economics, so I hope this will whet your appetite for more and not simply substitute for an encounter with the actual book. So in this handy three-step process, the first step, naturally enough, this is not rocket science, is to identify the dead ideas that matter. Now, I think at any time in our history, at any time in our current events, there's any number, there's probably dozens of ideas in our public life that we could all agree on. And there's hundreds more in our business or organizational or personal lives. But I think at any given time, there's only a handful that have the ability to really shape the destinies of societies and impose very serious consequences. When you look throughout history, this has always been the case. Up until the middle of the 19th century, for example, it was considered perfectly acceptable in large swaths of the United States to believe that an economy in which white people owned black people was moral and sustainable. Right? This seems absurd to us today, but it was an idea held by countless Americans back then, and it obviously shaped the contours of countless lives. Up until 1920, it was considered perfectly acceptable in many American cities and homes and communities to believe that democracy did not require the extension of the vote to women. Right? Again, an idea that seems ludicrous 89 years later, but which obviously was common at the time. Now, the six dead ideas that I'm going to talk about tonight, which are at the heart of the book, may lack the moral urgency of slavery or suffrage, but I want to suggest to you that given where we are in our history and in the trajectory of the American economy and of the expectations we have for our communities and our nation and the lives that we want and the possibilities for our children, the consequences of failing to unearth and address them are just as grave and so require the same amounts of urgent attention that I think all citizens should devote to them. So let me tick through briefly and give you a feel for these six dead ideas, and we can talk more about them, obviously, in the discussion period. The first dead idea is an idea that I call the kids will earn more than we do. The kids will earn more than we do. Now, that sounds depressing at first. I promise this has a hopeful ending. Why do I say the kids will earn more than we do is a dead idea? Now, what I'm referring to here is obviously the kind of sense of the American birthright of upward mobility, right? We were the original classless society. Our founders fled aristocracy and built a nation where immigrants have come from all over the world, where everyone has known that by hard work and pluck and persistence, your destiny is to go as far as this character and hard work can take you. Your destiny is not determined simply by where you're born. And the amazing miracle of the American economy over a couple of centuries has been that, by and large, every generation has found that it's been able to raise its standard of living. Now, this pattern has had enormously positive consequences for the American national character. We're the nation of inventors. We're the can-do nation. We've built an economy. We conquered the West. We've brought countless inventions that have benefited not just our nation, but the world. We helped win two world wars. We built the middle class after World War II. We put a man on the moon. All these things have led to a kind of optimism and a can-do-ness that's admired around the world. But I would submit that at the same time, there was an alternate side to those positive qualities that this kind of faith in the ever-rising tide has bred in us that doesn't suit us so well for these for the moment that we're now in. One of the chief things I talk about in that regard is I think that our faith in the ever-rising tide has led us as a nation to overestimate the power of the individual to shape his or her economic destiny. Remember, America was the nation where there was so much opportunity on offer that if you couldn't make it in America, it had to be your fault. And that sentiment, as one strand in American history, has shaped debates from the immigration debates 100 years ago to the welfare debates we've had today and in the 90s to other immigration debates today. And I believe we're in a moment where, because of the forces at work in the global economy, the power and rising presence of China, India, other rising nations, the rapid technological change that's changing the nature of how work is organized, again, some of these factors having nothing to do with anything an individual can control, we will see the idea that individuals control their own economic destiny challenged in ways that we haven't seen it before, because we'll see the threats to incomes begin to rise from the lowest income and less skilled workers among us up the scale. You already see legal work outsourced to India, engineering work, more and more categories of work will find themselves challenged by developments abroad in ways that are going to challenge this notion that this traditional notion that the individual controls and builds exclusively his own economic destiny. And I think the upshot of that is going to require a rebalancing in the American sensibility of how we think about the role of the individual versus the role of the community through government in assuring the kind of opportunity and security we think a wealthy nation like the U.S. should have. So that's the first dead idea. The second dead idea is what I call free trade is good, in quotes, no matter how many people it hurts. Now, I'm not a protectionist. I'm a believer in open markets. But what I also believe is that economists in both political parties who whisper in the ears of our leaders and help shape what the public discourse is on these issues have systematically hyped the virtues of free trade and tried to systematically shove under the rug the fact that there are many, many losers from free trade. Now, I think that economists have done this in ways that actually aren't true to what economics as a social science can say, and I go into some of the wonkier details of that in the book and quote some prominent economists who will acknowledge that economists have kind of politicized this conversation largely for reasons that I think are understandable at one level, but which actually hurt the cause they're trying to help in the other. What economists fear is that if they acknowledge more publicly that there are great downsides for large chunks of people from open markets and free trade, that will empower the forces of protectionism, which have existed in every society at every time. Businesses that have felt threatened by foreign competition are always trying to enlist the help of governments and trying to close off the borders and make it harder for their foreign competitors to do business here. And the economists worry that if they do anything to give ammunition to those voices, that will lead to a protectionist spiral that will end up having the dire consequences I talked about a moment ago, which is this kind of vicious cycle of beggar thy neighbor retaliation from countries in ways that hurts us all. But my own view is that by not openly talking about the losers from trade and what we ought to do as a nation about that to make sure we have more robust protections so that healthcare isn't linked to jobs, so that pension security is possible, even if there are changes in people's work situation, we will end up losing the consensus for the open markets and free trade that in the long run benefit us all, but in the short run undoubtedly hurt a minority of people very hard in the here and now. That's the second dead idea. The third dead idea is what I call your company should take care of you. And by that, I refer to the unique system in the United States whereby benefits in healthcare and to some extent pensions, but mainly healthcare still, are administered mostly by our leading corporations. Now, this may have made perfect sense in 1950, when healthcare was much cheaper, when the U.S. economy was the only economy left standing after World War II, and so we didn't face anything like the global competition we have today, and when you had, as a kind of paradigm of work, a single breadwinner, a male usually, working 35 years at a large company, and the family unit got those benefits around them. But today, when we know, 60 years later, healthcare is at 17% of GDP, headed to 20. Every other nation in the world, by the way, the wealthy nations are 10 or 11%. You've got business facing huge competitive pressures from overseas. You've got people working 8 or 10 jobs by the time they're 40 or 45. The employer-based system, this tradition, is something that is actually a piece of why we're in a situation where 50 million Americans go without health coverage tens of millions of more have inadequate health coverage, and millions fall through the cracks every day because we're trapped in this old way of thinking that amazingly to me, and we can talk about this more a little later, even as we're on the eve of what may be the biggest reform in healthcare in a generation, we will emerge from this with big business still being at the heart of the American welfare state. Why? Because that's what big business says it wants. This should be a mystery to us. In my public policy life and in my business consulting life, I try and talk to CEOs about all of this, and we can go into it more later if it's of interest, but it is a mystery to me why business is trying to cling to its role at the heart of the American welfare state when it would be better for business and better for the citizenry to de-link healthcare from employment. So that's our third dead idea. Now, the fourth dead idea is taxes hurt the economy, and they're always too high. Now, when I said this to Stephen Colbert, he said, taxes hurt the economy and they're always too high. Right. What's the dead idea? Why do I say that's a dead idea? Look, we're obviously cutting taxes as part of doing what we need to do to muscle through this recession. But there is no question that once we're past and we're on a stabler path of growth, in the next decade, taxes will rise as a share of GDP, as a share of the economy, no matter who is in power. We're going to be retiring the baby boom, which means we're going to double the number of people on Social Security and Medicare. There are already $50 trillion in unfunded promises in these programs. The math doesn't work at current levels of taxation, and even our current strategy, which has been to borrow from China for everything we want to do and not pay for it today, we won't be able to borrow the entire baby boomers' retirement from China. That won't work as a strategy. Even our creditors will at some point say, time's up. And yet this is an undiscussable fact in American public life for reasons we understand. Republicans have had great success with the tax issue since Ronald Reagan, and it also made perfect sense at that time. When marginal tax rates were at 70%, bringing them down to 28% and then where they've settled in the mid-30s, was a tremendous achievement and a boost to economic growth. Republicans don't want to let go of an issue that has been so important to them for so many years. Democrats are scared to death that if they talk about any of this stuff honestly and aren't for tax cuts too, just for different people or targeted in different ways, they will get destroyed at the polls. And so there's this conspiracy of silence in Washington. I quote in my book John McCain's two top economic advisors from the last campaign saying, of course taxes are going to rise in the next decade as a share of GDP. And this is even if you do anything that's well past the outer limits of restraint on spending, which I have advocated in Social Security and Medicare, the big items that are driving the budget. Anything we could reasonably do well beyond what Republicans have felt it was politically feasible for them to even begin proposing doesn't get you anywhere near close enough to close the gap between these trillions in unfunded liabilities and what we'll have to do in terms of raising taxes. And because there's a ban on any honest public dialogue about this, even though the facts are obvious to anyone who looks at them, it means that we don't discuss a couple of other important things, which is, one, the economy is going to be fine. We are not going to become Scandinavia or France or Sweden. Now, my friends on the left always say at this point, what's so bad about being France or Sweden? But we won't become anything like that. Right now, if our taxes and spending are around here, and you've got Scandinavia and Europe up here, we're going to go up somewhat and be somewhere in the middle, doing what we have to do to retire the baby boom, doing some things that I think we ought to do in public life that aren't just about services for people over 65, because if you're like me, and we'll talk about this in a minute, you think there's an unfinished agenda on education, on infrastructure, a whole bunch of things that have bipartisan support. But we're not going to become we'll still end up being, when the dust clears from all this, much more of a rough, tough, cowboy U.S. economy than any cradle-to-grave nanny state like we see overseas. And the other thing that we don't discuss because of this dead idea that is the obstacle is that we need to have a debate, given that taxes inevitably are going up, on what the best way is to restructure the way we tax ourselves so it is least harmful to economic growth. And in my view, that means taxing payrolls and corporations less and taxing things like dirty energy and consumption more. So that's our fourth dead idea, which is taxes hurt the economy and they're always too high. The fifth dead idea is what I call schools are a local matter. Now, let me be the first to say, I'm a huge believer in local involvement in schools. I'm very involved in my daughter's school. I have a 12-year-old. As I said, obviously a sense of parental ownership of the destiny of a school is essential to its success. But as with healthcare, America is unique among advanced nations in leaving it to 15,000 local school districts, lately helped in the last decade or so by a greater involvement at the state level, to do two things: set the standards for what kids should know in a 21st century global economy, and to fund the way we do schooling. And so a thing that we typically think of as a virtue, local control of schools, I always urge folks to always add local control and funding of schools, because it is our system of local funding, where the property tax in most states, as well as related state taxes, account for over 90% of what schools spend. And as a result, we have huge differences in the United States in what is spent per pupil in poor districts and in better-off districts. These are differences that no other advanced nation tolerates. Conservatives in other countries believe that, at a minimum, there should be equity in per-pupil spending coming from the government for different children. And many conservatives abroad argue that poor kids need more because they obviously have different disadvantages from their starting situation in life to overcome. But here, because we have the typical high-poverty district spending thousands and thousands of dollars less than its nearby affluent suburb, and because teacher salaries and principal salaries are a big payroll, is a big chunk of the budgets of any of these school districts, that means that we systematically assign the least qualified teachers in the country to the poor children who need great teachers the most. And all the research shows, from Republican institutes, from Democratic think tanks like my own, that after several years in their youngest school years with these green, unqualified teachers, these kids never catch up. And we've got kids going through, in every major city in the country, going through K through 6 with an underprepared, out-of-field teaching teacher recruited from the bottom of the college class to go teach in the poorest classrooms in the country. And this is, by the way, not to diminish teachers. I love teachers and cherish teaching and have proposed major programs to try and recruit and retain a new generation of teachers to our toughest schools. But it is the great teachers, and there are thousands of them, working their hearts out for these kids in poor schools who have told me with passion how mediocre so many of their colleagues are. And when you've got kids going from K to 6 in situations like this, these kids never catch up. What could be more unjust? Now, money is not the only answer, but the disparity in spending is a big piece of this, because when the suburban schools pay more, when they have much nicer working conditions, and when they have kids who come to school without anything like the myriad social problems that many of the high-poverty kids come to school with, so they're easier to teach, it shouldn't surprise us that we have the best teachers over time gravitating to the best suburban schools in the country, and we're essentially relying on the missionary plan to recruit teachers for our neediest kids. The missionary plan is not working. Local funding of schools is a piece of this that never gets discussion, almost never gets discussion, because it's considered a kind of sacred cow. The other thing that local control does on the standard side, as I mentioned, is leaves us as the only nation, or basically the only advanced nation, that won't say as a nation what we ought to be learning, what our kids need to know to compete and be viable in an increasingly competitive global economy. Now, President Obama and Arne Duncan have tried to move the discussion on that. It's always controversial, I know, because the typical joke in Washington has been, we don't have national standards in the U.S. because the right hates national and the left hates standards. That's sort of where we've been stuck. But you've got coalitions of governors across party lines. You've got a lot of work going on now at the federal level to try and move this conversation towards some kind of voluntary common standards that could develop into national standards. But at the pace we're going, this is going to take years and years and years at a moment when I think we need to be accelerating that. So that's our fifth dead idea. Now, the sixth and last dead idea is what I call money follows merit. And what do I mean by that? I believe, and this may not be true of all Americans, but I think there's a large chunk of Americans, especially educated Americans, who believe that Market capitalism in America is basically an economic meritocracy, that people end up economically where they deserve to. And I think that the trends we're seeing in recent years, where you almost a week doesn't go by where you open the paper and see another banking CEO who has retired to the country club with $100 million while his institution has essentially been gutted and the taxpayers are left holding the bag. And you've got more and more instances where you've got a level at the top of the income scale pulling away from the rest of Americans in ways that don't reflect anything that we would understand as merit or performance, but are the result of rigged systems of compensation that end up rewarding mediocrity or even failure as much as success. And I think this is very bad for capitalism. I write this book and I make these arguments as a capitalist who thinks that capitalism has the power. It's done more to improve the human condition for more people around the world and harness human ingenuity for human betterment than any system, you know, we as humans have yet come up with. But it also faces the real risk of a backlash if we've got segments of people who are feathering their own nest in ways that can't be squared with any ordinary notion of merit or performance, and that will spark a backlash against capitalism that will end up hurting us all. So those are the six dead ideas. We can discuss your own if you want, because there's dozens more we could add in the discussion period. So remember, the first step was to identify the dead ideas that matter. Those are obviously my nominees. The second step in this process is to understand each dead idea's story. And by that I mean, I think you can't really make sense of or understand the source of a dead idea's power unless you understand where it came from. And so each chapter in the book, I tell a kind of mini biography of the dead idea. What was its genesis? Where did it come from? What were the circumstances? Why did it make sense for a long time, arguably? What changed in circumstances that now makes it problematic or dangerous or harmful? And what are the forces at work in the interests that have a stake in preserving the dead idea even long after it should be buried? I want to give you one example of that related to healthcare, since it's so topical, as a way of illustrating what I mean. The dead idea in healthcare, remember, is that your company should take care of you, our unique employer-centric system of providing healthcare benefits. Now, the way that the policy wonks usually tell the story of how we got to this way of doing things is misleading, I think. The way the story usually goes is in World War II, there was a wage and price freeze as part of wartime policy. Benefits were exempt from that wage and price freeze, and so a lot of companies began to offer things like healthcare benefits as a way to attract and retain employees. And the federal government came in not long after the war and ratified that arrangement with a huge tax subsidy, which today actually nationally is about $300 billion a year, that subsidizes the provision of health care through employers, and the system grew like Topsy from that. Now, that story is true as far as it goes, but it makes it sound as if our unique and poorly understood corporately administered welfare state was the sort of accidental byproduct of wartime pricing policy. I think the much more interesting story dates back to earlier in the 20th century, in the early 1900s, when you had the first backlash brewing against the excesses of early industrial capitalism. Remember, there were sweatshops were on the rise, coal miners dying in the mines, unions beginning to form in Europe. Labor parties were forming that were edging that continent toward socialist ideas. And the American business community and its conservative political allies, seeing these developments, got together and said, we need to find a way to put a lid on the growth of unions in the state. And the strategy that was arrived at, not from six guys sitting around a table, but the de facto strategy that ended up being adopted was for big companies, and there were many big vertically integrated companies at the time in a lot of our industries, to begin offering things like the early versions of health benefits, some pension benefits, paid vacation, different recreational activities, ways to share the bounty that workers had helped produce with workers as a way to diminish the energy behind either the growth of unions and the growth of the state. And at that time, in the 19-teens and 1920s, and again after World War II, when the situation I described began to take hold, American corporations, because they faced so little competition, were able to pass on, through slightly higher prices, the cost of a good chunk of the American welfare state. And that worked, as I said, you know, in the 1950s and 1960s, reasonably well. There were a chunk of folks left out of this, but it worked reasonably well for a middle-class society that was being built, that was growing. We had the government step in when certain conditions like the inability of senior citizens, obviously, to get health coverage in the private market, big problem. Political system stepped in with Medicare in the mid-1960s. It worked reasonably well. But if you look at the evolution of the system in that historical light, I try to argue to business folks and to citizens generally that seen in that light, the employer-based healthcare system was a vital tool in our long twilight struggle against communism and socialism. But that war was won 20 years ago. That's when the Berlin Wall came down. The threat today is not all temporary bank, federal investments aside, and cries of socialism from some quarters today, which I think are just not true. The real threat we face today is not that America will become socialist, because it never will. The real threat is that America will become protectionist for the reasons I've suggested, as millions and millions of workers feel insecure on basic things like health care and pension security in a global economy that's going to impose increasing strains. And when you look at it that way, understand the story of that dead idea, you begin to see why we ought to be evolving past the employer-based system so that people can have security in these matters without it being linked to their job. So we've identified the dead ideas that mattered. We've understood each dead idea's story. And the last and third final step in this handy process is to reach for new and paradoxical ways of thinking. I want to be brief here so we have time for discussion. But I think based on a more clear-eyed assessment of the facts and the situation, we want to look for what ideas, once you understand the story of where we've come from and why current practices may make little sense, even though they don't get routinely examined, points us toward new ways of thinking that make more sense for this era. I have seven destined ideas in the book that I laid out. Let me just very briefly highlight them for you. You can obviously see more in the book. And the point I want to make about these is these ideas sound paradoxical now, and so I state them as kinds of paradoxes, but I think that really reflects our own skewed way of thinking, and that when we look back around the year 2020, these things, just like I said when we talked about 1928 versus 1940, will seem in retrospect, we'll ask ourselves, why didn't we realize this is the way that history was trending? So here are our seven, very briefly, our seven destined ideas. First, only government can save business. By that, I'm not referring to things like the current banking situation or the auto bailouts, but I mean only a bigger government role in funding healthcare and pensions can free business to do what it needs to do, which is compete more effectively in a global economy. And there are ways to do this that I lay out in the book that don't involve anything like socialism, but involve market-friendly ways to do universal coverage and greater pension support consistent with American values. Next, only business can save liberalism. Now, my liberal friends say, what do you mean by that? Two sectors in our economy, healthcare and education, are radically inefficient. We spend much more than other advanced nations. We're getting much less out. It will take a major national imperative in the next decade or two is to re-engineer the cost structure of healthcare and educational delivery so that we are getting more for less. Because as the boomers retire and so much money that we devote as a nation is going to go to their healthcare and pensions, if we don't re-engineer healthcare and education, the cost structures of the way we do that, we'll never be able to spend the money we want to spend on things that aren't just for senior citizens in our society. And I would add, we're going to face a rising tide of anger from the younger generation when they realize that all public dollars have been pre-committed and they have no ability to address what they see as emerging priorities on their own. And I think in our society, the innovative entrepreneurial energy of business is where we've always gotten the ideas for how to get more for less. That's been the story of American invention from the beginning. It's what business people do. And yet healthcare and education, for various reasons, have been kind of immune to some of those forces. And I think business has a huge role to play, and there'll be huge opportunities for business in re-engineering the cost structure of those two sectors. The next destined idea is only higher taxes can save the economy and the planet. By that, I've already discussed, taxes are going up, and the way we need to do it or should do it is to use it as an opportunity to restructure the way we tax ourselves in ways that are better for economic growth. Only the lower upper class can save us from inequality. By that I mean what I call the lower upper class in the book, the professionals who have by and large not shared in the sort of surreal bounty that's emerged at the very tippy top, and have also noticed that there's a kind of disconnect between merit and some of the rewards that we're seeing today. And this lower upper class, just as they did in the progressive era, and I talk about this in the book, can form the nucleus of political energy that sets in motion some of the reforms I think we need today. Only better living can save sagging paychecks. By that I mean not just, and we've seen a taste of this in this recession, but I think even bigger challenges lay ahead as we begin to see more economic integration with rising powers like China and India. More and more Americans will find that upward ladder at risk, and we're going to have to find ways to have better lives, because we'll still have, by any measure in America, even for those affected by some of these forces, very affluent lives compared to all of human history and compared to the rest of the planet. But it may not meet some of the expectations that we've had in the past in terms of the ever-rising tide, and we'll need to find ways in a renaissance of cultural values and ways to find contentment and satisfaction that don't depend only on consumption. I think we've seen a taste of that in a recession. I think that trend is going to be only be amplified in the years ahead. Only a dose of nationalization can save local schools. By that, I mean a greater federal role in school funding and national standards. The plan I like for school funding, by the way, today the feds spend about 9 cents on the K-12 dollar. I don't want to nationalize it, but I would like us to go what I think of as the Nixon plan that would get us to 25 to 30 cents on the national dollar. What I found in doing the research for this book is that Richard Nixon, before he got sidetracked with something called Watergate, was on the verge of proposing what his aides referred to as his education masterstroke, which was he had set up a commission led by the chairman of Procter & Gamble to study school funding inequities between wealthier districts and poorer districts, something we haven't seen a president take on, even a progressive president like Barack Obama, ever since. And Nixon was about to propose a federal tax. He was going to do a modest version of a value-added tax that would then be rebated to states, conditioned on them lowering property taxes and lifting the bottom. You're obviously, you can never stop communities from spending all they want to spend if they're wealthier on their schools, but lifting the bottom. So those schools would have a chance to attract and retain the kind of teachers and personnel they needed. And his plan would have taken federal spending from around 6% then up to 25 to 30%. So I'm a late advocate of the Nixon plan for education reform when it comes to school finance. Then finally, the last destined idea is that only lessons from abroad can save American ideals. Why do I say that? I think we've become incredibly parochial as a nation. When you talk in Washington about, geez, you know, there's something we could really learn from how Singapore is doing pensions today, or we really ought to study what Finland is doing on teacher training because it's remarkable. The general response you get in policy circles and political circles in Washington is, well, that's fine for some, you know, benevolent dictatorship in Asia and a city-state, or for some sauna-loving tundra of the North, but we're Americans, damn it, you know, we're going to do it our way. And this doesn't square with our own history. We designed our university system largely after what we admired in the Germans. We designed our government, absent the monarchy, largely by what we thought the Brits had right when they were setting up separation of powers and that kind of thing. And so I think that the pressure of events in years ahead are going to force us, in an important way, out of this parochialism and draw some lessons in how to adapt. Nothing ever adapts whole, but how to learn from other nations that are doing a better job combining growth and equity than we are in the United States today. So to sum it up, oh, I should say, by the way, one thing that I'm often asked is, you're talking about these destined ideas, but you've also just told us that so many ideas end up, all these ideas over time become dead themselves. Why should we listen to you when the things you're laying out as destined ideas are probably destined to be dead and useless themselves? And I take that very seriously. I think it's a very fair question. And that's why I'm offering what I believe is an unprecedented 10-year warranty on these destined ideas. So that if at any time one of these ideas is not working for you, you bring it back and I will fix it. Or if I can't, I will replace it with an entirely new idea. So to sum it up, identify the dead ideas that matter, understand each one's story, and reach for new and paradoxical ways of thinking. Now, This process is so straightforward, it's a little hard to understand how we keep getting trapped in these dead ideas, but I think we shouldn't be too hard on ourselves. The perils of orthodoxy at moments of sudden or pervasive change have been with us forever. The blind spots bred by complacency or arrogance or certitude or habit fill the obituaries of civilizations that didn't make it, of businesses that didn't make it, even marriages that didn't make it. It's human nature, and it's the things we think we know but don't that are often the chief obstacles to success in nearly every endeavor. In the end, however, the true measure of a person, an organization, or a society is not the dead ideas we fall prey to. It's whether we can summon the perspective and imagination to identify the dead ideas in our midst and bury them before real damage or more damage is done. Thank you.
You've been listening to a special program on Noon Forum. We've heard the 14th Annual Governor's Lecture in the Humanities, presented by the Nebraska Humanities Council, the University of Nebraska, and Valmont Industries. Today's guest speaker has been Matt Miller, author of The Tyranny of Dead Ideas, Letting Go of the Old Ways of Thinking to Unleash a New Prosperity. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Wednesday evening, November 4th, 2009, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Jane Hood, Executive Director of the Nebraska Humanities Council, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings are available on the Internet. Visit our website at kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.